Excellent. An ale for me. And for my officers. In fact, ales for everyone.
Oh. Turn backwards. Rick and work. And Will.
Oh, yes.
Hello and welcome to episode 5 of 10 Backwards, a Star Trek podcast based in the UK by 3 super Star Trek nerds. We are nerds for super Star Trek. That's a new thing I've just invented with that phrase. I myself am Rick, and to my right hand side is my friend Richard.
Hello.
And directly opposite me is my friend Will.
Hello.
This episode, we're going to be talking about the film Star Trek Nemesis. Everybody's sucking their teeth in like a plumber who's just seen a dodgy set of pipes.
Also, this is episode 5. I hope it's better than Star Trek 5.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
For the record, we have no 3-breasted tiger women.
Oh,
or do we?
No,
I'm just checking. No, we don't.
We don't, yeah, we don't.
Which is good, because essentially there was a stripper that was drowned by Captain Kirk, and I don't really know what message that sends out, but it's not a great one. But moving on, let's go on to a film that's it's kind of get the same sort of credit as Star Trek V, doesn't
it?
Nemesis is not considered, it's not well liked by a lot of fans.
Yeah, it's it left a sour taste in a lot of people's mouths, and it killed the franchise.
There's a statement I take issue with. I don't think it did.
Well, that's what we'll be discussing the heck out of over the next hour.
Yeah, right. Imagine that it's like discussing a celebrity that that died in an embarrassing way, but that celebrity actually wasn't too bad.
Yeah,
that's interesting. I like that you put that out there right at the beginning of the podcast. Keep it in mind for the rest of the time now.
Oh, it's a bit like what happened to Michael Barrymore. No one really knows, but it probably wasn't his fault. in terms of killing the franchise, it wasn't Nemesis's fault, but it was there.
We're not sure what Nemesis did, but at the end of it, the franchise was phased out. No, I'm not even going to go there. That's an incredibly poor taste.
Oh, goodness. I'm not sure if what we've just said is libelous or hilarious.
It's not anti-Michael Barrymore. Maybe a little anything, it's pro-Barrymore.
It's high libelous.
Anywho.
Right, so can we maybe just have a quick go through of what actually happened in Nemesis. What was this film about? What's the story?
Synopsis, if you will.
Right. The synopsis is down to this guy, Will.
Will is so, here to put the sin in synopsis.
The film, yeah, indeed. The film opens on Romulus with the horrific murder of the Romulus Council, basically, the government. They all die.
If I can interject, Praetor of the Romulan Empire at this point is played by Jim Robinson from Neighbours.
And to be fair, he doesn't die of a heart attack.
No, he dies of being dried out into weird dust.
Yeah.
But that's for certain people of a certain age. You may remember Neighbours in the late 80s, the Australian soap opera. Sorry to any American listeners who will be like, what are they talking about?
He played a dad in the OC.
He's in 24
He died of a heart attack in the OC as well.
First, I think series 2 and 3 of 24, he was the vice president.
That's right, yeah.
I remember him from that.
Alan Dale.
Oh, and he turned up in Torchwood, the Doctor Who spin-off, as a scientist who made giant wasps.
Okay. I've just remembered something. We were talking about Star Trek Nemesis.
Sorry.
The synopsis, if you will. So the film opens fairly bleakly. Then we cut to Troy and Riker's wedding, which is fun, and you very, very briefly get to glimpse Wesley Crusher and Guinan, and an actress who looks a lot like Ro.
Michelle Forbes.
Yeah, but it's not her.
No,
if she was still alive, she would be a wanted criminal.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. That's right. Yeah,
but chances are the Jem'Hadar killed her dead.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, Ro fans. If in the books she's fine, but
Michelle Forbes is okay.
She was originally slated to play the Kira role in DS9.
She was
I believe.
Indeed, but she wanted no part of it.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I think she didn't want to be sort of typecast, or I don't know, or didn't want to be in Star Trek. So anyway, yeah. So there's a big old fun wedding. Then the Enterprise receives a message. They pick up a signal, and it's the signal from a positronic brain. Only what? Data has a positronic brain. What the heck's going on? So they go down to a planet. They find an android in loads of different bits buried in the sand for some reason. This is the character B4 when he's assembled. Then they get attacked by some miscellaneous aliens for no reason.
Sand people.
Yeah. I believe they are called... Let me just check my notes. Right. Colorans. I don't know if that's actually mentioned in the film. They mention it in the director's commentary, but
I think they name the planet as Corallis something.
Yeah,
number. I'll say three. Three is normally. But yeah, I don't know if they specifically. They talk about it having like a civilization. The society on the planet. I've lost the ability
it's
to.
Like
talk.
Industrial level.
Yeah,
industrial level.
Just hitting industrial level.
Right. Yeah. So there's sort of a Mad Pre-war. Max style chase sequence. Which we'll get into a little bit later on, I think. For no reason, it has no impact on the plot. Just fills some time, and it's an action sequence. Then we come back to the Enterprise, and Shinzon shows up. Wait a minute. They assemble B4, and then Shinzon gets in touch. Picard goes to dinner with a character called Shinzon. And it turns out he's a clone. He's a clone of Picard. He was created by the Romulans to be a spy. He was going to replace Picard on the Enterprise at some point, and that idea was abandoned. I mean, instead of just killing that clone or whatever, he gets sent to is it Remus? Is that prison colonel Remus? where he eventually through a fairly long scene where he establishes it does a big old exposition dump on Picard, and it turns out he's now the leader of the Remans, and he's going to be the new praetor of Romulus, and he's extending he just wants peace with the Federation. But it turns out he doesn't want that. He wants Picard's blood because he has some kind of weird disease, and
he was supposed to be aged to match Picard.
Yeah, and that's right. And as a byproduct of that.
So
his cellular structure is breaking down, and the only way to fix it is a full blood transfusion from the genetic match, which is Picard.
Although he never really seems too keen on that, having that procedure happen. I don't know if we even see the procedure in the film. I don't recall, but anyway, he decides he wants Picard's blood. But then a bit later on, he decides he doesn't care about that, and he just wants to kill Picard anyway. And for some reason, he's going to attack Earth. And basically, he sort of wants to start a war. The Romulans don't want to go along with it. He goes, to hell with you guys. I'm gonna go and attack Earth. Why? What's his problem with Earth? Why doesn't he hate the Romulans? It was the Romulans that imprisoned him on Remus. Anyway, he decides for no reason. He decides he hates Earth and he's going to attack Earth. And he also wants to kill Picard because while Picard's alive, he can't be the real Picard. Some such thing. Anyway, he has a variety of motivations which are confusing. And the second half of the film is a big old space battle with Shinzon's ship, which is the Scimitar. It's a big old sort of gothic kind of bird of prey. The Enterprise is crippled. It rams the Scimitar. Data beams on board to rescue Picard. He's already got.
Picard armed. Beams on board. Yeah. Data doesn't beam.
That's right. Data does a space jump.
Just jumps out of a hole in the side of the Enterprise.
Much like a
finds the Scimitar's back door.
Yeah, much like a sequence we sort of see in. Cheeky. Much like a sequence we've seen Into Darkness later on, but less exciting. Data saves Picard and shoots a phaser into Shinzon's.
It's a Thaler emitter, right?
Yeah, it's a doom. It's a doomsday weapon. The ship blows up. Data is killed. Everyone is sad. Picard forces his Chateau Picard wine on everyone. Everyone drinks. It's sort of a bit bad taste, but no one really talks about it. Riker gets his own ship. The film ends. Everyone's sad. That's basically the way the plot goes.
Pretty much, yeah.
You have left out the element that just before the film ends, there is this tiny ray of hope when the B4 android starts to sing a song that we saw Data singing. And we did have the moment where Data transfers his memories to B4.
Yeah.
So there's always hope that somehow Data will reemerge in B4's body. But
he never did.
The more I watch that, the more I have a bit of... I find that troubling. Just asserting your memories onto someone else because you're a bit better than them.
Yeah, well, what's to say you're better than them? They have a lower capacity for learning and things. It's kind of it's a bit like that third X-Men film where when Professor Xavier is like disintegrated by Jean Grey, he basically transfers his life into a coma victim.
Yeah.
And they say, well, he was brain dead. Like, yeah, but was he? Are you sure? Are you sure that there was no hope? Because they were still keeping him alive. Mm. And what about the original personality?
B4 wasn't even brain dead.
No,
there
was
slow.
Something. Yeah. So you're basically... It's a worrying message that you can interpret from that, really. But I think what they were aiming for was that little ray of hope that you had at the end of Star Trek 2.
Yeah.
With the mind meld.
Yeah. That's it. And Nemesis does riff on Star Trek 2, The Wrath of Khan, a lot. And by riff, I mean rip off.
Well, I think... Do we have to be so harsh on Nemesis for that? Because I think it was a lot subtler than Into Darkness.
Well, how about we talk about the making of the film?
Yes. Okay, yeah,
and,
sure.
And what was the development of it?
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah. So it was made in 2002. It was about 4 years after the last film, Insurrection. Mm. And I think I got some stats here about. Because it made the least amount of money of any Star Trek film. It was the only Star Trek film that didn't go to number one in its first week of release. Whoa. It cost $60 million to make, and it made $67 million. Now, Star Trek Insurrection made $112 million, and that's in 1998 money.
Yeah.
So you could probably add like another $10 million. So essentially, it made twice as much as Nemesis did. However, these are the top 10 films of the same year, 2002. So the top film of 2002 was the Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers. That made $926 million.
Crikey.
Then you have Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, $878 million. Spider-Man, $821 million. Star Wars, Attack of the Clones, $649 million. Men in Black 2, $441. And then down, Die Another Day, Signs, Ice Age... My Big Fat Greek Wedding and Minority Report. Minority Report made $358 million.
It made less than My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Yeah. But,
I love Minority Report.
Yeah, Minority Report is a great film. So, I mean, I think those stats themselves, they do point to that the film being released at the start of the era when films were starting to make a bunch ton of money. And things were changing and also... One thing I did see is that Nemesis was released in December, middle of December 2002. Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets was released in November. Mm. And Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers was released the week after Star Trek Nemesis. So you have the two biggest films of that year around Star Trek Nemesis. So to be honest, I really think it's like a hiding to nothing in terms of making money. And then when you add in, a great film, and it's slightly old-fashioned in the way it's made. You can see why it's starting to not make money, and you definitely can see that it's. I really don't think that it's the film that killed off the franchise. I think it was just made at the wrong time.
It's a stiff competition that year. I mean, you get to that point in December, and you got people have got blockbuster fatigue. They spent a lot of money at the cinema that year, and they've still got, like you say, they've got Lord of the Rings to come.
And the previous year that already been, so there had already been a Harry Potter film and a Lord of the Rings film and a Star Wars film not long before this as well, in between Insurrection and Nemesis.
That's three films that are in immediate follow-ons to big franchises people are into.
It's the start of...
Star Trek is not following on in that way. It's a standalone film in a big franchise, but, you know, it's...
So yeah, it was directed by a guy called Stuart Baird, and I had a look at his previous work, and the one film I did recognise was one called Executive Decision, with Kurt Russell and Steven Seagal, kind of like a counterpoint to Air Force One, I think. So, he was the director that was chosen. There was a rumour that it might go to Jonathan Frakes or even LeVar Burton. They both said that they would have accepted if they were offered it, but the studio Paramount overruled them and put this guy in charge.
I always wondered, because obviously Frakes had directed the previous two films.
Yeah, he said that if he'd been in charge, he would have brought it more toward more stuff involving the crew rather than focusing on Shinzon. So yeah, I mean, and Stuart Baird, he's come in for some criticism in terms of the film. He was criticised by Jonathan Frakes, Marina Sirtis and LeVar Burton. LeVar Burton I can understand, because he kept getting his name wrong and he didn't realise that Geordi was a human. He thought Geordi was an alien.
I have heard that. Didn't Marina Sirtis say that he never watched an episode of Star Trek?
Yeah, they to the point they thought he maybe hated Star Trek. and I have to admit, I watched Nemesis on Friday and I watched the deleted scenes. And the deleted scenes, they have a little bit of commentary beforehand where they talk about them. So in some of them, Patrick Stewart will. And in a couple of them, Stuart Baird does too. And to be fair, like, the points he makes about why these scenes were removed seem fine. In general, I didn't get anything about him that seemed like... I mean, I don't think that a director has to love the thing that they're making for it to be successful. I just think that he was given charge of a film by a studio and had to make it, and when you do that, that potentially can lead to problems.
I think we talked a bit about Nick Meyer on our previous podcast, and he's a guy who came in to Star Trek 2 with no real Star Trek experience, but he threw himself in and watched a load of it and got his own sense of what it was about.
Yeah. He was also considered for Star Trek Nemesis, but he wanted to rewrite the script. See? And the studio had given that to John Logan, and John Logan had exact control over the script. But then I looked at John Logan, he wrote the script for Gladiator, he wrote the script for The Aviator, he was involved in the last two Bond films, Skyfall and Spectre. So he has writing chops. He got an Academy Award nomination for Gladiator and I think for The Aviator. So it's not like this guy can't write a screenplay. But the story itself involved John Logan and Brent Spiner, and maybe again that's where there's just like too many cooks spoiling the broth. I do get the sense that the stuff with B4 was a late addition to the story. I sense that it's the thing in the story that doesn't work the best.
It's quite an elaborate bit of Shinzon's plot.
Exactly. Yeah, it does feel like it's worked
in. When you consider if someone stumbles upon a Soong-type android, which are pretty rare.
Yeah.
Because in total, there's Data, there was Law, there was Lao, and there's B4. So that's four in existence. Only one is in fact functional. And then you stumble upon this other one, and you think, brilliant, what am I going to do? Oh, there's loads of things I could do with this. Hang on, I'll use an elaborate plot.
And did he find it in bits, or did he break it up?
I don't know. Well,
bury it?
You assume that he buried the bits on Clarus, left them there where he hoped the Enterprise would pick the signals up as they come come by. But that was before he'd even reached out to the Federation, so it was a bit by luck that Enterprise came by at that particular time.
In my headcanon, I like to assume that maybe the Romulans came across before years and years ago. And he's in some kind of a Romulan warehouse where they put stuff that they can use against the Federation, but they don't know what they're going to use it for yet. And maybe Shinzon came across this.
Maybe he was sent to Remus just to be a minor.
I find it very difficult to believe that if they came across an android of that level of complexity, they wouldn't have made use of him or broken him down and built copies. So it's kind of really, really.
Rick's just. There is a.
I think actually there is an interesting story that Jerry Ryan, who played 7 and 9, was offered a role as a cameo role in for this film. Something that it was going to be just a cameo scene at Troy and Riker's wedding. Makes no sense. But then at a Star Trek convention in 2014, she admitted that the studio had offered her a much larger role, which would have replaced an unspecified character in the film. But she passed on the opportunity because she didn't want to take a break from a show called Boston Public, which she had just joined, and also she had fears that she might be typecast. Her being in that film would make no sense now. In terms of the character, I think that 7 and 9 would have replaced in this film. I think she would have replaced B4. I think that's the character space that she would occupy.
Okay.
And then she rejected that, but then they did offer her a cameo, as a guest at Troy and Riker and Troy's wedding. But she rejected that because it would just be making no sense. So yeah, I think maybe early on they had this script idea that John Logan wrote with 7 and 9, and then she rejected that, and then Brent Spiner got involved, and then the B4 stuff happened, perhaps.
I imagine in Brent Spiner's first notes, he wrote in B5 and B6 and B7 and B8, and maybe
BM.
B10 was like a crazy New York cup, and B5 is like,
well,
I don't know.
B9 was an idea for the name, because it sounds like B9. So yeah, it essentially, looking at, in terms of the development of the film, it seems like a film where in a way it kind of got cobbled together. They had an idea, the studio had an idea of the director it wanted and the writer it wanted, and then they put together the basic story and they made the film, and this was the best thing that they had. And it was made in an era where they felt like they kind of needed to make choices about what was involved to get an audience, and it really seems like a piece of cinema that was made at a time when these kind of decisions would create that kind of work. In terms of the films that were being made at the time, I think the early part of the 21st century was the point where it was the origins of what we have now, where there are lots of sequels and comic book movies and films that only consider successful if they make $1 billion. It was the origin of that scene, and I think that the Star Trek films were still being made along the lines that they were made two decades before. It was Paramount maybe were just a little bit old fashioned in terms of how they thought about making a film, because they reuse a lot of the sets from the TV series, like you were saying in the last episode, CBS and Paramount had a much closer relationship back then, and I think, to be fair, I really don't think that Star Trek Nemesis was the film that killed off the franchise. I just think it was just a film made in an era when everything was against it in succeeding, and the way it was made. It's not the worst of the next gen films. It's probably the second best, really.
I think in what Nemesis did that I don't think any other next-gen film managed was actually it did feel a bit more cinematic in it.
And it's not cheap. It's not cheap either. In Star Trek Generations, they reused the explosion of the Klingon Bird of Prey from Star Trek VI. In Insurrection, they don't bother with doing any special effects Collector.
I'd argue it still is a bit cheap, because I watched it with the director's commentary. And they were talking about there was a lot of things they didn't have budget for. So originally there was going to be a bigger space battle at the end. There was going to be
fleets, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it got whittled down to two birds of warbirds. Romulan warbirds. Yeah, And in the planet with the dune buggy chase sequence, it's the way they didn't have the money to kind of film a location that looked like an alien planet, so they just went out to, it's just somewhere in LA, and they just bleached out the film so that it looked like it was sort of a sun-drenched planet, and that wasn't a stylistic decision. It was just they had to do something to make it look like an alien world.
And a lot of the time they just go out. A lot of the time they went out to the same set of rocks near Las Vegas.
Oh, Vasquez Rocks.
Yeah, and they never did it. But at least like taking that bleaching the film, it did have an effect that we'd not really seen them try before. So I almost want to give them points for that. Really,
they didn't reuse anything, and they didn't decide just not to do something. Like the stuff on the Collector and Insurrection is unforgivable, I would say.
Yeah.
Have we got any things that we particularly feel are highlights for Insurrection? Things that actually we looked at, we do enjoy?
The scenes with the Enterprise E and looking at it, I like that. The fight, the battle in the nebula is good.
I liked Riker and Troy's wedding. I thought that was good. I quite liked Picard's best man speech.
Doesn't he take a bit of it from Balance of Terror from the original? Because in Balance of Terror, I think Kirk is officiating at a wedding.
He's officiating, yes. Picard's not officiating, he's best man. I don't know who officiates.
But the speech where he says, what is it? No, you know what I'm thinking of?
Data's Day when he marries.
No, I'm thinking of Generations. No, what is it where he says that since the days of Tall Ships, it's been the prerogative of a...
Isn't it Data's Day?
I think it is Data's Day,
okay.
Because actually, that was
They deliberately reuse. Yeah. No, because it's a bit... But I just really like that whole sequence. I felt like there's the cameo from Guinan.
Yeah.
And...
she would have been a cool person for him to talk to about his shins on problems.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know who else would have been a cool person to talk to? The ship's counsellor.
Yeah.
What? I mean... But to be fair, she has her own problems.
Yeah.
With the whole Shinzon thing.
Oh, yeah. It's something I didn't mention in the synopsis. She gets mind raped.
Yeah.
By.
Twice?
By Shinzon. Yeah. Well, no, I think once. But
there was a second time.
That's a deleted scene.
Because the great. With Troy, obviously, she'd begun as sort of this generic woman, you know, with the big hair and the silly costume. But they did have this thing towards the end of Next Gen where they actually gave her quite strong roles. If you look at Face of the Enemy, getting the Bridge Command stuff. Rather than so for the final film, they thought, what can we do with Troy? Let's make her a victim.
Yeah. But I actually, one of the things I like about Nemesis is that she gets a moment where she's on the bridge, but she actually gets to do something useful. And I think it's maybe the first time in Next Gen where that happens, because of the mind rape, she's then able to pinpoint
she does take that sort of, she has that return and on
it,
that, and
it's like, it makes no sense, because what are her powers exactly? She can detect people's obvious feelings, and yet in this sequence she's able to pinpoint a ship in a location in space.
I think the fact that he's invaded her mind, I think we're supposed to believe there's maybe a residual link that she didn't want to, but for the sake of this, she will work back on that and re-establish that contact. But I still don't understand how then a computer's spatial coordinates can be drawn.
In the film, she's sort of pointing. She's pointing at the screen, and she's guiding.
She moves Geordi's. Worf's hand, right?
It's almost like a Ouija board.
But I don't know, that kind of worked.
I like it because it gives her the chance to strike back, at least.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, that's something that Shinzon didn't expect, and it's almost like he's getting his comeuppance in a way, because it was his own fault for doing a mind rape. It's like, well, if you're going to do a mind rape, you better make sure that mind raper can't track you back and see through your cloak and then order a ship to fire on you, because that's what happens.
That's rule 101 in mind rape.
that's right. But I like some of the early scenes just sat on the Enterprise. I just like the scenes where Geordi and Data are hanging out a little bit, and then there's a few scenes where Picard and Data are hanging out, and just nice. It just it feels very.
This is the thing next with generation. Next Gen. Yeah, because it's that whole like. I think I touched on this in some of our early podcasts. That how much I like Next Gen is like almost like this familiar friends feel, and they, you can just have them chatting on the bridge, and it's such a really beautiful, warm, comforting scene to sit and watch, because it's like, oh, it's those guys again. I love those guys.
Yeah.
And so when they're chatting about something silly like Worf doesn't want to go naked at the wedding, and obviously Picard's ribbing him on that, and big strapping young fella like you, and then as he goes, I'll be in the gym. It's like, it's just, oh, Picard, you've lightened up so much on this, on the Enterprise E.
Yeah, it really has.
And the Enterprise E can handle itself. Like, it annoyed me in Generations that the Enterprise D went out pretty meekly.
I never felt that was. Yes, they were able to breach the shield, but still a tiny bird of prey compared to a galaxy class starship. And Riker fires back once.
That's it, and then he starts messing around with some kind of firing.
You will blow that thing up before it gets you.
Yeah,
and that's a weak showing for Riker, and I feel it undermines his character because he's a strategic genius. It's stated throughout Next Gen.
Yeah,
he's a tactical master, and he should have taken that bird of prey down easily.
Yeah, it was one bird of prey.
So they had to serve the story in a particular direction, but it's sloppy and lazy. I think the way they did it.
The story itself, I don't mind the idea of a Picard clone. I think originally the idea was that Patrick Stewart would play Shinzon.
Yeah, that's what I'd heard, and I think would have been cool. I would have loved that. I mean, it would have been a little bit silly.
Patrick Stewart.
Yeah.
It
would have been fun.
Yeah.
I mean, they would have had to lighten the tone of the film a little bit.
Do you think
Brent
Spiner nicks that and he's like, I'm the only one who can play. He can play against myself.
I think potentially.
It's not like Tom Hardy is a bad actor. Tom Hardy's very good. I know it's a lot earlier in his career. He's like, wasn't that well known then, but. And I like that it's trying to explore some themes. Essentially, it's talking about nature and nurture, isn't it?
Yeah, this is
Picard, and he grew up in a loving family in France, and he had the benefit of Earth and the paradise of the Federation and the training of Starfleet, and this is what he's become and made himself. And then we got the guy who was basically grown for a purpose, then kicked into some mines and abused by guards and raised in a violent way.
And turned into a crazy old psychopath. Mm.
With a diva's wardrobe.
Yeah.
It's nice as the parallel thing in terms of, as Data points out, there's him and B4 have, it's not quite the same, but B4's like, they talk about they don't aspire to be better. Like B4 doesn't necessarily have the programming to do it, and Shinzon doesn't have the will to do it, whatever it is that he lacks to make himself better. But then I suppose that's their own narrow definition of what's better. Shinzon is fighting to be for a better life and what he believes his circumstances are, I suppose. So it's a matter of perspective.
But it feels like the film could have explored that idea a bit more. I feel like it touches on that idea, and it's a nice idea, but they just don't really. It feels like if that idea had come up in an episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation, there wouldn't have been a space battle. Obviously, there would have been. There would have been a lot of really long meetings about
Picard would
about
have talked
what was
him round, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what would have happened. Picard would have talked him round. And then we would have never heard of him again.
Yes. Yeah.
But I think when you look back at... I've said in previous podcasts that Insurrection is maybe not a great movie, but it is a fantastic two-part Next Gen episode. And I think that's maybe what the studio wanted to move away from. They want to say, we want a film. Give us a film. Don't give us an episode.
Yeah. And maybe that's why they chose a
I think maybe
director.
That's why they veer towards that. And I think maybe that's why we have things like the Dune buggy thing. Mm. It's excitement. It's spectacle. It's not chatting about how we can freeze time with a nice lady and watch a hummingbird flap slowly.
I think the thing with the Dune buggy scene is that. It's a bit jarring in terms of the kind of what we've seen so far of Picard. I had a look for a clip that kind of showed the kind of interest that Picard has in general, and I didn't want to go for, you know, like a really good episode, like The End of Light or Tapestry or The Measure of a Man, where you see Picard as this kind of intellectual, kind of thoughtful man. I thought, which is also a great episode. I want to get a shot of that in an episode that's not very good. So in season two, there's an episode called The Royale.
Ooh,
Royale.
Royale.
Try saying that three times fast. Which isn't very good. It's not a great episode.
No.
Agreed. But at the beginning of the episode, there is a clip where... well, let's just play the clip.
Yeah.
Fermat's last theorem. You're familiar with it?
Vaguely. I spent too many math classes daydreaming about being on a starship.
When Pierre de Fermat died, they found this equation scrawled in the margin of his notes. X to the nth plus y to the nth equals z to the nth, where n is greater than 2, which he said had no solution in whole numbers. But he also added this phrase, remarkable proof.
Yeah, that's starting to come back to me. There was no proof included.
Mm-hmm. And for 800 years, people have been trying to solve it.
Including you.
I find it stimulating.
So yeah, in that episode, he riffs on maths in his spare time.
Yeah, he finds it stimulating.
He says, like, x to the n plus y to the n plus z to the plus z to the n.
He always raps it. So much he loves it.
Yeah, see? Rappers look to you like, he's
and yeah, it is a bit jarring that he's suddenly got is this one specific shuttlecraft with a dune bug in it with a laser cannon on the back. If he wasn't, I could get that if he likes driving cars, that's fine. But he's got a holodeck for that, right? He could drive any Grand Prix he wanted to. He could do anything he wanted.
I'm gonna counter your point by referring to a Series 6 episode called The Chase, where Captain Picard's old archaeology professor comes on board, and he brings with him a gift,
a Curlin Nesca.
Which is Picard, essentially like a Russian doll kind of
Picard
stuff.
Almost jizzes in his pants when he sees that.
Yeah. What Picard says is like, there's all these tiny little figures inside the larger one, and saying all the multitude, the aspects of a person that make up the whole. And he says that's about himself.
A person is a person of persons.
And I think Picard specifically says he is very much someone who has many different facets inside him. He's like the guy who loves maths, the guy who loves Shakespeare, the guy who loves Dixon Hill holodeck novels, the guy who wants to be a starship commander, the diplomat, the soldier, the archaeologist, you know, and...
The guy who likes his personal relaxation app.
And the guy who races dune buggies for fun, and the horse rider.
To be fair, I in agreement with Rick, although I actually agree with Rick, that's Richard. Also, in Tapestry, we see Picard, when he was younger, was reckless. And he picks a fight with a bunch of Norsicans. Mm. And so we kind of know that he has it.
I guess he has that potential. That's fair enough.
In the director's commentary, the director says...
What's his name?
His name is Stuart Baird. Baird. he says that he sees it as if Picard's maybe having a bit of a midlife crisis, and the dune buggy is sort of a way of him to sort of maybe kind of recapture his youth and relive some adventure. But he also said, which, okay, I kind of think maybe I could buy that, but he also points out that the film, he felt that the film was really dialogue heavy, and it was kind of dragging, and that it needed an action scene. And it really feels like, from what he said, the only reason that dune buggy sequence exists is because otherwise there'd be an entire hour of the film with no action. And so they had to come up with a dune buggy that has a gun on the back. And
there's a scene where they escape the Scimitar in a Romulan shuttle. I really like that scene. I think that's good.
I think that's
an action scene, and that doesn't seem out of character.
And also, that action scene moves the story on, which the dune buggy sequence does nothing but fill time.
Yeah,
they could have imagine if that sequence wasn't there, and they found before, and they went back to the ship. That changes nothing in the story. But the action sequence where they escape the Scimitar. Yeah, summertime.
Yeah.
It is essential in the story. That's a key thing that happens.
I am going to throw out a little bit of an idea, though. A few years after that episode was put out, Fermat's Last Theorem was proved.
I read that,
It was solved.
Oh, right.
So, at that point, are we then in an alternate timeline where Picard has not spent years obsessing over this math problem and has really got into Dune buggies? Who knows?
That is a point I had not expected. I have nothing to counter
just,
that
just
with.
Just throwing that out there. It's like, oh, I would love to have like worked on Fermat's Last Theorem. Someone did that in 1994. What am I going to do? Dune buggies.
Well, at what point does that split off from...
I would know. I'd be interested to know then. What in the 24th century is it canon whether or not the theorem's sort of proved or what? That's an unanswered question. But it's not relevant to Nemesis. So.
Very little of what we discuss is relevant to the.
Relevant to the subject of the podcast is not really something we're totally into. It's not no. what we're about.
Hey, we're not bound by the subject of the podcast. I'll say that.
Do you think maybe there's also a case that the Star Trek films, in a way, had just run out of steam? Like, there was just a general...
I think there was a feeling that maybe we had hit franchise fatigue, and not just in terms of the films, but in terms of the series too. And I think some of that may be that... TV programs were changing and evolving. We were getting into serial arcs more, and Deep Space Nine had embraced that. Voyager hadn't. It had poked its toe in the water and thought, that's cold. And never, not doing that again. And Enterprise initially started without, you know, just going as they were.
And then they embraced it maybe too hard in season three.
Yeah, and they flamed it. I think they hit a good balance in four with sort of multiple... You know, many sort of
blocks of three episodes.
Yeah. There was connections, but you didn't have to be there every week, kind of thing. But that was kind of too little, too late. But yeah, I don't know if franchise fatigue is a funny concept. We'd had a lot of Star Trek solidly since 1987. I don't know. I
wasn't fatigued.
I kind of tailed off with the first three series of Enterprise. I look back and I appreciate them more now.
Do you know what? Actually, no, I did, because I there were episodes of Enterprise that I hadn't actually seen until I ended up buying this whole series on DVD a while ago.
I enjoy them now, but I find it difficult going until series four, and then I was hooked completely.
Yeah,
but again, too little, too late.
I thought this indie arc series was really good. I really like season three.
Yeah.
I have mixed feelings about the Zindi.
It has its... Yeah, I mean, it doesn't solidly hit every time. But this is the difference, isn't it? This is why going for a full series long arc was difficult, because there were points when they run out of steam and they had to come up with a time travel back to Chicago in the 1990s or something. It's a bit like, really?
Ugh.
Or the Wild West town.
Yeah, there's a terrible episode. It's a terrible Hoshi episode where she falls in love with some. I can't even bring myself to describe the plot because it was so boring.
Yeah, so it was a good attempt, but maybe they should have done it as a half season arc and then had something.
Sort
of follow up. I don't know, but it's I just think TV. Star Trek was struggling to move with TV at the time. Which is a shame, because in Deep Space Nine they kind of set that trend a little bit with serialized arcs. And
And moving from TV to the cinema nowadays, it wouldn't happen. It's a concept that's not really done anymore because more money's put into TV, I guess. And idea of TV has changed.
I always find it quite interesting that people say, "Oh, Nemesis killed the franchise because it didn't make the money. You know, they weren't going to make any more after."
But I don't think it did.
A lot of people talk in... if you read stuff on Memory Alpha, people say, it became apparent during filming this would be the last one. Well, then you've not really given it a chance to make the money, isn't it? It's kind of like...
Yeah.
Paramount said, okay, put this one out, this is going to be it, we're going to make loads of money off it, and then halfway through, actually, I don't think we will. Forget it. Let them finish, but we'll not make another one.
It feels like there's a lot of elements in Nemesis that give it a sense of finality. Like
we see Riker,
that's it, yeah. And then I believe there's some deleted scenes as well where we would have seen Beverly Crusher
Going back to Starfleet Medical.
At least this time,
she got to film a scene that she said she was going to do it, unlike in, like being fired between series. But
yeah. But I think I was looking at some of the technical aspects of Nemesis, but in a way I feel like we've kind of discussed on from that, but just briefly, from listening to the director's commentary by Stuart Baird, one of the interesting things, because the film is really dark, not only in its subject matter, but in the way that it's shot. And one thing he mentions is a kind of looking at sort of early kind of German horror cinema and like lighting a lot of things from below, so it's sort of underlit, and the particularly the Riemanns look like kind of horrific monsters.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a Nosferatu kind of vibe going on.
Definitely.
I think Ron Perlman plays the Vice, the Riemann Vice. Yeah, his name is kind of like a version of Count Orlok, who was the count in Nosferatu.
He's the one that Riker has a punch up with, yeah, isn't he?
Yeah.
There's moments where he talks about how his kind of frustration with taking working with existing sets and existing designs, and he says that he likes to put his own stamp on things. And one thing he was able to do was to change the colours. Some of the graphics, so he was going for darker kind of blue tones and some of the more colourful graphics, which is interesting because it's sort of telling that he's a director that begrudges the fact that he's working with existing sets and designs and working in an existing franchise rather than being really excited.
Maybe that's where the sense that he hated Star Trek comes
think
from.
So, yeah, I think so. I think it feels like it was a frustration that he didn't have control over the design elements and the way the film looked, because that already had to be there. Some of it's quite stagey. Some of the early scenes with Picard and Shinzon really, really drag on. And in the commentary, it's mentioned that a lot of stuff was cut from those scenes. I found myself thinking, really? Like, a lot of it was cut, and yet still this scene feels like it's an hour long. But I don't know. And then it really sort of picks up in the second hour, and it does feel a lot more cinematic than, say, Insurrection.
Because I think the previous ones were all, both First Contact and Insurrection were obviously Jonathan Frakes, and Generations, I think, was David Livingstone, and those were directors who came basically from directing the TV show.
Yeah.
And so I think it kind of, you know, there's it just, and also there is the thing that actually, you know, the special effects level between that, you know, is all model work. It's very similar stuff. So you don't, it's, whereas original Trek to a movie, there's a huge special effects jump. That doesn't happen the same way. So it's difficult to make them feel, with TV directors and with the same level of effects generally, you don't get that feeling of the cinematic thing. And I think you got a lot more of that in Nemesis.
And there's one really fantastic sequence in Nemesis, which is of course the bit where the Enterprise E rams the scimitar. It looks fantastic. It was all done with it wasn't all done with model work, but they did build a model of the Enterprise and the scimitar and just smashed them together, and then they kind of enhanced it with CG. In the commentary, the director's always on about, oh, this scene was enhanced with CG, but these were model shots. I think that really adds a bit of weight to that that collision. I love that sequence. I just think it's great. It's one of my favourite Star Trek moments. It happens in a film that I don't care for so much.
And it's great because it's that realisation Picard has. He thinks he knows what I'm going to do next.
Yeah,
I'll show him.
And it does maybe.
Coming,
it does riff a bit on the whole Khan and Kirk relationship, riffing on something and sort of having a callback to something. There's a fine line between ripping something off and riffing on it. And I don't know. Maybe Nemesis crosses that line, but there are.
I think it's good though that you've got your captain and you've got a villain, and they've got that confrontation. Mm. And I think that works really. It works beautifully with Kirk and Khan. I think it works quite nicely with Picard and Shinzon. That they have this chemistry between them. Yeah, but as you say, I don't think that Shinzon's plan necessarily makes any coherent sense.
I think that's one really of the bigger.
Does he want to take over Romulus? Does he want to destroy Earth? Does he want to get Picard's blood? Does he want to kill Picard? I don't know. Yeah. What does he want, really?
Where did he get the scimitar from? They mentioned that it's constructed on a secret base. What secret base? But how's that? That ship's massive. Where did he get the Tholon, what's it called? Tholon radiation? Thaleron radiation. And there's kind of like that sort of web-like emitter that he's going, where's that all come from?
Yeah, how did he even stage his coup? I mean, from being a kid on, like a human kid on Remus.
I
think that's supposed to be that, you know, he's got a certain element of Picard in him. There's a leadership and a gravity to him that it makes him a good leader and people will follow him. And he's a determined fighter and everything. And all these things that you can say are part of the Picard thing. But, I think there's loads of good moments, loads of bits in it I enjoy, but as an overall thing, I don't find it overly satisfying as a Star Trek movie. I kind of feel like it's left dangling. We should have had something more. It's like, are you the end? Are you leaving this open? And if you are the end, you're kind of a bit of a downer.
Yeah. I think that's it. It is a real downbeat film, and it's not a high way to end. No. It wouldn't have upset people so much if it wasn't the final film, if that wasn't the way the Next Gen movies ended. If that had come before, say, I don't know, Insurrection and Insurrection, oh, I don't know. No one would have wanted Insurrection to be the final Star Trek movie.
Oh, I don't know. It's a different. I'm sure I've read that there were plans to follow it with a really big Star Trek event. It was going to pull in
right.
other, you know, characters from other series.
And yeah, like Voyager issue. And DS9 crews would team up. I'd read something about that, but I don't know where that information comes from.
No, I think Patrick Stewart himself has said that John Logan was working on these plans to basically sequel Nemesis up and have this big thing, and that would probably be the end point for it. You know, and I guess that Riker would be on in the Titan, so you'd have Enterprise and Titan and potentially Voyager and Defiant. Yeah. Could have been huge.
It could have been amazing. I think I would have loved
it. It's every
that.
Trek nerd's wet dream, really. Yeah. To throw it all into the pot, isn't it?
Definitely.
Yeah. But I don't know. It's like. But then they sort of seem to be. And Nemesis was going to be the end before it was released. It was always touted as the generation's final journey.
Mm.
So it's kind of like, even if that had done amazing at the box office and pulled in billions, would we have seen that? Well, yeah, we would have, because if it made a lot of money, because Paramount would milk it for every last dollar afterwards.
Yeah.
So.
But I don't know. It's not the dog that everyone.
I think people are overly harsh on it. I mean, you know, it could have been a lot worse. There are nice moments. I find Riker and Picard's goodbye scene at the end is really, really, really nicely done.
Yeah,
it really gets me.
And the send off that Data gets. I know we've joked about Picard forcing his Chateau Picard wine on everyone. But it's a nice little speech, and it's really well played as well. All of the cast, they look like they're pretty emotional in that scene. And they've worked together for years, and it's the kind of scene that the cast that have worked together for that long can really nail. And
yeah, I think that's why Frakes and Stewart nail the Picard Riker departure scene as well, because it's got that ring of finality to it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a little bit the last shot, just the Enterprise being repaired. You could at least try and have been launched, get a sense that she's off on new voyages again. But, I don't know. See, I was coming to this thinking, right, I'm going to defend Nemesis up and we're going to actually sort that and establish. We have kind of ripped it a bit more than I kind of thought we would.
Yeah.
I think we're saying to cut it a lot of slack, and we are finding good points, but I think we're also finding these flaws in it, aren't we?
I don't think it's it's not the fault of Star Trek Nemesis that they stopped making those films. It was going to happen, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's good. The franchise needed to rest.
Yeah. And I think now's the great time to be, you know, making a TV series again. It's TV's in a really strong point, stronger than it was, I think, when Star Trek's in a better position to be on TV now than when Nemesis was, I think. I think Enterprise was made, and then when that finished, there was no real incentive to make another series.
No.
But now, there's, because of things like Netflix and Amazon and the ability, money being put back into television.
TV is in a very different place now, and I think this is a good time for Star Trek to come in. And, you know, the world is in a different place now, and I think it definitely needs that sort of thing that Star Trek brought back in the 60s. That sort of optimistic outlook, and that's something I hope Discovery can do.
Yeah.
I think that's where we maybe started to lose it a little bit towards the end. As I say, it was a very downbeat ending in Nemesis. So
yeah.
There was a lot of optimism felt from the end of that.
A little while ago, I think it was maybe years ago now, we all got together in Lincoln and watched all 12 Star Trek films back to back in the Ritz Cinema in a big Star Trek movie event.
Ooh, it was
spread
it
over
was,
two
it was
days.
Cold.
It was freezing.
It was cold, yeah.
I kept warm by holding a cup of tea sort of between my legs and hunching over it like it was a makeshift hot water bottle. There were some films there that were a struggle to get through. Slow motion picture, Interaction. But you know, surprisingly, I really enjoyed seeing Nemesis, even though it was the 10th film that we'd sat through.
Couldn't feel our hands.
Yeah. perhaps it's because it is quite cinematic, and coming straight off the back of watching Insurrection, seeing something cinematic is pretty exciting. Or perhaps it's just because it's one that I haven't watched so much because it's not very good. But I don't know. I really enjoyed it in the context of all the other... The other films.
Well, I put it on the other night in preparation for this, and I enjoyed it.
I found
it completely watchable. You know, it might not be the send off for the next gen that we wanted. And if someone said to me, "Oh, do you think they should do something to really just sort of close the book on next gen?" I think they deserve that. Yes,
but I think if Discovery does well, I think the chances of that happening. I mean, Sir Patrick Stewart, was really kind of passionate about filming Logan and giving that character, Professor X, his version of Professor X, a send-off.
Yeah, he has said he wouldn't rule it out if the story was good.
Yeah, if Discovery does well, then you never know, we might get that send-off.
That'd be amazing. That's the dream.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I think feels like we've come to the natural end of discussing Nemesis.
I think we have.
I think we'd better put that to bed. Then put ourselves to bed.
Absolutely.
I'm tired.
We don't live in a kind of Malcolm and Wise style three men in a bed situation.
No. No, that would
be pretty hilarious.
It'd have to be a strong bed.
I've got an hour's drive home after this, so
yeah.
do appreciate that Will supplied me a coffee through this breakfast.
Arachigino,
yes. If we're winding up, you can find us on the interwebs. My personal Twitter is at nerdrick, and on the Twitter, our official 10 Backwards Twitter is at 10 Backward. And you can also email us on 10backwardpodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, if you want us to discuss any particular Star Trek topics, you can get in touch with us there. Let us know, and we'll look into it.
If you look on our website, www.lowerdecksradio.co.uk, you can also leave comments on the forum page, on the blog pages. So that's, I think, that concludes our defence of Nemesis, in which we have said it's pretty okay if you don't get too caught up in it.
We haven't defended it very hard. But we've all enjoyed it.
It's just we know what we don't like about it.
And it's a lot.
But isn't that true of anything in life?
It's worth watching, you know, if you're a fan of Tom Hardy. Which a lot of, you know, ladies are.
And a lot of fellas.
So, thank you so much for listening. Live long and prosper.
Can we say that?
That's not copyrighted, right?
I don't know. If it is, I'll cut it out.
I think it's a beautiful sentiment. I don't see why we can't use it.
Yeah.
And have we decided what we're discussing on our next podcast?
I don't think we have. We talked a lot about Star Trek tropes, and we've mentioned Star Trek tropes.
I think we're quite excited about Star Trek tropes. I think that is going to be our next subject.
Star Trek tropes, the podcast.
Please join us for that when we're going to discuss the tropes of Trek.
Oh, yeah. It's set in stone. We've said it now. We can't go back.
There's no anything you say on a podcast is legally binding.
Oh no!
Uh-oh. Oh yeah, forget that. That's not legally binding. Anyway, bye.
Yeah. See
you. Thanks for listening. Bye. Love you.
Let's make sure history never forgets the name.
Ten backward.
Daddy, don't you think you should rephrase that?
Ten backward.
Ten backward.
I don't believe this dialogue. Did humans really talk like that?
Not in real life.